We're in a country with vast resources, vast expertise, yet we're looking at 100,000 dead. Sir, how on earth did we get here?
Every death that we've experienced is a tragedy.
Tonight, a Dateline investigation. Inside America's COVID-19 response.
At what point did you realize that there was a freight train coming down the rail at us?
Very early on.
We weren't prepared. We weren't even getting prepared.
It was like a ticking time bomb. Catastrophic failure.
We uncover insider emails, White House documents, and for the first time in detail, lay out the pandemic playbook that might have changed everything.
Could lives have been saved if we had acted more quickly?
For sure, lost time is equivalent to lost lives.
Do you not ask what mistakes were made, what things should have been done? Why was there not more urgency?
You can't imagine a greater sense of urgency.
The Playbook.
Good evening, I'm Lester Holt. With the nation's attention turned to George Floyd's death and demonstrations across the country calling for equal justice, you might not have noticed, the COVID-19 pandemic remains rampant and deadly. In fact, as the country opens up, some states are seeing an alarming surge in cases. Tonight, we look back on how it all began and ask the White House, did it really have to get this bad?
It's getting really bad here. This is something we've never seen before.
It was like a tsunami, the human toll of it.
Please do whatever you need to do, but please do not let me die.
The cost of COVID-19 has been staggering. More than 100,000 people in the U.S. have died. 2 million have gotten sick, and tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. The devastation has been unimaginable.
I would view it as something that just surprised the whole world.
But back in 2016, a team of White House insiders did imagine the devastation. That's why they wrote this, a 69-page government document stamped with the seal of the president's office. It is a step-by-step guide for White House officials, a playbook to stop a pandemic in its tracks.
So the intent with the playbook was, here are the things you need to focus on at first. Here are the important questions to ask when you begin fighting.
With no disrespect for anyone, would it be fair to call the playbook Pandemic for Dummies?
I think that it could be called Pandemics for Dummies.
Tonight, we are going to crack open the playbook and investigate what could have been done to fight the virus. Then, we'll show you what actually happened. It can be hard to remember what life was like back in January, but for many of us, it was a time of new beginnings. A high school student had just celebrated her Sweet 16 in Queens, New York.
She had the time of her life. She danced throughout the whole night.
A young mother from South Georgia was training for a new job. And a singer from New Jersey who'd gotten her big break on The Voice was planning a European tour.
That was just exciting to be living my dream.
It's lives like these the playbook was written to protect. Lives that would be knocked off course by a virus out of control. COVID-19 first reared its head in Wuhan, China. But as January got underway in Washington, D.C., most talk of China involved trade deals, and Congress was gearing up for President Trump's impeachment trial.
I think it's fair to say that in the first, few days in January, there were questions about how bad this was going to be. And
Dr. Beth Cameron, who talked to me from home, was the playbook's chief author. She is a highly regarded health security expert who has worked for both Republican and Democratic presidents.
When you guys wrote the playbook, was your intention that it was going to be the, in case of fire, break glass, this is what you want to use?
The purpose of this document was to be used on a regular basis.
For the past 20 years, with varying degrees of urgency, presidents have prepared this country for a pandemic.
They can kill those who are young and healthy as well as those who are frail and sick.
The Trump administration has produced a number of detailed pandemic plans, too, and just last year ran a multi-state pandemic exercise, But the authors of the playbook say their guide was different. It was meant to be a simplified roadmap for White House officials to help them efficiently coordinate government plans, a tool to save time, because in a pandemic, time equals lives.
These are very unusual events.
Jeremy Konondike, an expert in international disasters, helped coordinate the government's response to Ebola. He watched what was going on in China with increasing alarm.
You were part of this team that had written this playbook. At this point, is it now becoming less abstract and becoming very real in your mind?
What was clear was we needed to move to a no-regrets posture in the United States.
In other words, prepare for the worst. In early January, the Centers for Disease Control set up a team to monitor the outbreak. On January 9th, they got word from China COVID-19 was a disease we hadn't seen in humans before, what's known as a novel pathogen. That's the type of pathogen the color-coded playbook says should trigger an elevated threat level and prompt questions like, do we have access to biological samples of the disease, critical to making tests and vaccines? But there were concerns the CDC wasn't acting fast enough. 3 weeks went by, and according to this email written by a top government scientist, the CDC hadn't officially asked China for samples yet. That's a problem, he wrote. The Department of Health and Human Services told us efforts were made, but China was uncooperative.
At what point did you realize that there was a freight train coming down the rail at us?
So very early on, this virus had very serious features that raised concerns to me.
Dr. Luciana Borio has spent her career studying infectious diseases. Up until last year, when she left for the private sector, she monitored global diseases for the National Security Council inside the Trump White House.
I couldn't imagine a situation where we would not have already had cases circulating in the U.S., given the amount of travel that takes place between our two countries.
Were our policymakers slow in recognizing the reality of the situation?
You know, Lester, it's very difficult to know. I had left the White House in 2019. My sense is that it's important to catch the attention of our policymakers who may not be necessarily trained in public health and infectious diseases.
NBC News has learned a number of people were trying to catch the attention of policymakers early on. Ken Delanian, who covers national security for NBC News, says the intelligence community started flagging the virus in December. In January, the virus was included in the president's daily brief.
We know from our reporting that it was included in the president's daily brief, which is some of the highest level intelligence gathered in one place in the government. It was included in that brief more than a dozen times.
The White House has said there were no explicit warnings in those briefings, and it's unclear if the president ever read them. We do know that on January 21st, the CDC announced the first known case of coronavirus in the United States. The next day, President Trump gave some of his first comments about the disease during an interview with CNBC.
Are the words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and we have it totally under control.
The playbook authors weren't so sure. They wanted to know what the government was doing about testing and getting hospitals and healthcare workers ready for what would be the fight of their lives.
I realize they're speaking in hindsight, but what do you think was the first major mistake by the administration in tackling this?
I think the overriding mistake is the magical thinking that we saw in January and February that somehow a virus that could ravage China to the degree that we saw playing out in front of our eyes was somehow unlikely to pose the same risks here.
Coming up, another mistake was just around the corner.
We found out that the U.S. did not have a working test.
I was really surprised.
Where were the tests?
We weren't prepared. You know, we weren't even getting prepared.
By the end of January, the playbook's color-coded charts would have been flashing red. China had put the entire city of Wuhan, a city the size of London, in lockdown. On January 31st, President Trump banned entry to this country for foreign nationals who'd recently traveled to China.
You know, the president says by restricting travel from China, he saved a lot of lives. Does the evidence support that?
It's definitely possible that the travel ban did save a number of cases from coming into this country. But Lester, there were already cases here.
We know America's first official COVID-19 patient returned home to the U.S. from Wuhan in mid-January. NBC News has analyzed flight data collected by FlightAware, an aviation intelligence company, and determined that as many as 8,000 people flew here directly from Wuhan in January. How many of them brought the virus? We don't know. Where did those people go? Who did they infect? We don't know that either, because there was no widespread testing being done. Playbook author, Dr. Beth Cameron.
This is epidemiology 101. This is how you stop an outbreak from becoming an epidemic or a pandemic.
Dr. Luciana Borio, the infectious disease expert and former White House insider, agrees. She wrote about the need for widespread testing in a Wall Street Journal op-ed in late January.
You were beating the drum for testing very early on.
That's right. Without testing, we don't know who is sick. We don't know how many are sick. We can't act. We can't isolate.
On page 32 of the playbook, the authors address testing, asking if the states have diagnostic capability and capacity sufficient to trace and monitor for an outbreak. The answer in January and early February would have been no. The only lab in the U.S. that could run a COVID-19 test was initially inside the CDC. It wasn't until February 6th, 17 days after the discovery of the first case here, that the CDC shared testing kits with selected labs. 2 days later, they got bad news. Many of those test kits didn't work.
We found out that the U.S. did not have a working test, which costs some valuable time. Does that surprise you that could happen, and was there a remedy for that?
I was really surprised that the United States had so much trouble with testing capability across the country. I think the real problem in this case was the failure to understand that it was happening and the failure to come up with a backup plan.
Labs like this one might have been a big part of any backup plan.
Unfortunately, the CDC test, you had a perfect storm, and so we got late for testing. So you can
kind of see. Dr. Alex Greninger is the assistant director of the University of Washington Medicine Virology Lab in Seattle. Even before that first CDC test failed, Greninger's lab had already started developing its own test for COVID-19, but it needed permission from the FDA to use it.
There was a frustration that there were going to be a lot of requirements. You know, we just knew that it was going to cost time.
When weeks passed with no tests from the CDC, Greninger and concerned colleagues from other labs lobbied Congress for help in cutting through the red tape. In late February, Greninger's lab got the green light they'd been looking for.
And so within about 72 hours, we were live for testing.
That was progress, but CDC guidance limited testing to people exhibiting symptoms or travelers from infected areas. On the other hand, South Korea identified their first case on the same day the U.S. did and started widespread testing in early February. By the end of that month, South Korea had tested nearly 100,000 people. The U.S., 472.
We weren't prepared. You know, we weren't even getting prepared.
Though COVID-19 had been here since at least January, Kanindike says that in mid-February, he learned firsthand that some members of the administration still felt the disease was a foreign threat.
You attended an informal meeting. There were science experts. There were some folks from the White House. What can you tell us about that conversation?
They were not talking about measures that they were taking to prepare the homeland. They were not talking about hospital preparedness. They were not talking about planning for social distancing measures or anything like that. Virtually everything that they were talking about was the travel ban, the quarantines of returning travelers, traveler screening. You know, it was clear where their head was.
We now know that the virus was killing Americans long before any widespread testing began. Autopsy results have revealed that a San Jose woman had died of COVID-19 on February 6th, the same day the CDC's faulty tests went out. As the calendar flipped from the lost month of February to March, most Americans, assured that everything was under control, carried on with their lives as if nothing had changed. That was certainly true of the people we've met. That teenager from Queens, remember, was counting the days to spring break. In Europe, that singer from New Jersey was living her dream on tour. And in Albany, Georgia, that young mom was feeling on top of the world.
February, I would say that I was living my best life, you know, not really afraid of, you know, what was going on, because I don't think it was that big at that particular time.
None of them suspecting that an invisible killer was stalking them. Coming up.
I understand that disruption to everyday life may be severe.
A warning from a CDC official and a White House backlash.
Trump reportedly, according to our sources, was angry at her candor.
When Dateline continues.
We have it totally under control.
The immediate risk to the general American public remains low.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
The job of tracking pandemics was once handled by a single office inside the White House, part of the National Security Council. But Trump officials disbanded that office in 2018 and reassigned the staff. They say the reorganization didn't result in a loss of expertise. But NBC News' Ken Delanian says it came at a cost.
There were biodefense experts who remained at the NSC in other offices, but there was nobody at a senior level who could have the president's ear, who was an expert in public health and global pandemics.
Trump officials say they were following their own highly detailed pandemic response plans and insist those plans were more useful than the playbook. But Jeremy Canundike says we still weren't moving fast enough.
I think if we'd been following the playbook, there would have been planning underway from late January for the kind of physical distancing measures that might need to be applied depending on what we saw the virus do.
We do know that alarm bells were going off since January. Officials from the CDC, Homeland Security, and other federal agencies had been talking to outside experts who warned we were falling behind. In an email chain with the subject line Red Dawn, they discuss what we should be doing. A senior medical advisor with Veterans Affairs wrote, "I would drop almost everything we are now doing and prepare for implementing TLC NPIs. That medical jargon covers social distancing. A researcher noted, "We need the citizens to know and practice social distancing." And then on February 25th, someone said it out loud. A CDC official made a pretty notable and alarming statement to reporters.
Yes, Dr. Nancy Messonnier, who at the time was the head of the CDC's task force on this, said that Americans should expect disruption to their own lives.
I understand this whole situation may seem overwhelming and that disruption to everyday life may be severe. But these are things that people need to start thinking about now.
Dr. Messonnier's phone call with reporters came as China and Italy were already facing lockdowns and severe disruptions. Businesses closed, economies tanking. Within hours of her comments, the stock market took a dive.
And there was a backlash. Trump reportedly, according to our sources, was angry at her candor and wanted her muzzled. We don't think that she was muzzled, but she never again put things in such stark terms.
And the next day, the president, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and a different senior CDC official dedicated an entire press conference to walking back that comment from Dr. Messonnier.
Thank you, Mr. President, for...
Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services, tried to refocus on the travel ban.
The president's early and decisive actions, including travel restrictions, have succeeded in buying us incredibly valuable time.
At that same news conference, the president announced a change.
I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge.
But the person who took charge at that briefing was President Trump.
So far, your administration is only testing less than 500 people. Are you planning to test more people?
Well, we're testing everybody that we need to test, and we're finding very little problem.
This was the first of many news conferences where the president would take center stage.
Some of the doctors say it will wash through, it will flow through.
What does the playbook tell us about messaging, about communicating to the American people?
The playbook addresses communication by saying that there should be single, clear, designated, science-based communicators.
In the absence of a clear, consistent message, Americans continue to pack into restaurants, movies, offices, airplanes, and churches.
Never in a million years did I think the disease that started in China would not only reach Albany, Georgia, but spread as quickly as it did.
Terica Parks lives in Albany, Georgia, about 3 hours south of Atlanta. In early March, she was asked to perform for a youth program at a local church. Four days later, Terica was sick with COVID-19.
I was in so much pain that it caused me to get in the middle of my bed in a fetal position, just praying, please, please let the pain go away.
Terica had fallen victim to an outbreak that hit Little Albany, Georgia, like a tsunami. Health officials believe someone sick from out of town had brought it to a funeral in late February. Some of those mourners also attended Terica's church performance. Now, in the hospital and deep in misery, she started a video diary.
I want to be able to hug my kids, kiss my kids. I want to be able to hug and kiss my husband. Lord, please, please, give me my life back. Please, God.
The outbreak killed more than 140 people in and around Albany.
We saw how fast this could move. South Georgia, a bunch of people attend a funeral. Hundreds get sick. Some die. How could that have been avoided?
Well, that could have been avoided if we had had better testing and better surveillance.
There were a number of super spreading events that caused the virus to run wild, beginning in February. Services at a synagogue in New Rochelle, New York. A corporate conference in Boston. A series of family gatherings in Chicago. A choir practice near Seattle, and two massive gatherings, Mardi Gras and spring break in Florida.
Could lives have been saved if we had acted more quickly?
For sure, lost time during any pandemic is equivalent to lost lives.
By mid-March, events would start moving at warp speed. The virus had taken aim at New York City, and everything the playbook was designed to prevent was coming to pass. Coming up,
we will be suspending all travel from Europe.
Was that a moment in which you felt a little better about messaging?
No, I was actually very, very concerned about the Oval Office address.
As the coronavirus rampaged through the country in early March, few Americans seemed to be paying close attention. Then came March 11th.
And you see the teams heading back to the locker room.
When a player tested positive for the virus, the NBA suspended its season. Tom Hanks posted that he and his wife were positive too. And President Trump went on primetime TV.
To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
Americans abroad began the scramble home, crushing together in airports. Felicia Temple, in Europe on a singing tour, got an urgent call from her husband.
He's freaking out, and he's like, "You have to get home. I will fly you home."
We now know the virus had been flowing into New York from Europe unchecked for weeks. And the president's second travel ban did nothing to satisfy the playbook's authors.
Was that a moment in which you felt a little better about messaging?
No, I was actually very, very concerned about the Oval Office address. What we really needed to be focusing on was building up our public health capability in the states and building up our capacity to test.
But the president offered no specific policy to curtail the spread of the virus inside the U.S. as cities and states began closing down.
There was a lot of inconsistency in when different cities and different states began to employ stay-at-home orders. You know, one of the things that I think is really revealing is the difference between Seattle and San Francisco on the one hand and New York City on the other hand.
The playbook was written, its authors say, because days matter when fighting a pandemic. The federal government began recommending social distancing on March 16th. Modeling from Columbia University suggests if the government had acted even a week earlier, 36,000 lives might have been saved. The cost of waiting in New York City, the epicenter of the virus, was enormous.
Sources that I talked to in public safety and city government say that the real issue here was a failure of imagination.
Tom Winter, an NBC News correspondent for Investigations, has been covering New York's response to the pandemic since early January.
It wasn't thinking about the tourists that were coming in from Europe that might have had the virus. It's not thinking about those subways that are going to be packed with riders, one person on top of the other person, sneezing, coughing. How's that going to go?
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and the city's mayor Bill de Blasio hesitated to close down the nation's largest school system. And there were more than 16,000 confirmed cases in New York before a stay-at-home order took effect. Since then, the mayor and governor have defended their actions, saying they moved as fast as possible during an unprecedented crisis and were hampered by a lack of support and reliable information from the federal government.
There's no question that the actions taken by the governor and the mayor in shutting down New York City when they did helped save lives. But there's also the possibility that some of their early inaction cost lives as well.
Carla Duarte was one of those New York City students who'd been attending school up to the middle of March. A few months back, she'd celebrated her Sweet 16 with a huge party, wearing a dress she adored, dancing up a storm. But in mid-March, Carla began to feel tired. A cough, chills, and fever followed. Carla's mom, Anna, became seriously concerned.
And I told my husband, I said, let's get ready. Let's get ready and take her to the emergency room.
Carla was diagnosed with the virus. Things went downhill quickly. Within days, she was moved to the intensive care unit. She was struggling to breathe.
And she even said on that day, she said, you know, mommy, when this is going to be over, and I saw that she was really suffocating.
When a ventilator didn't help Carla, the head nurse told Anna her daughter could go on an ECMO, a breathing machine of last resort.
And she said, but this is like 50-50, you know, 50-50.
How could it have come to this? A healthy teenager now fighting for her life in a New York City hospital that was itself on the front lines of a worsening war. Coming up, the mad scramble for masks. Where was the safety equipment?
Who or what is to blame for the shortage during this crisis?
All I can say is we are not prepared. Even now, it's a catastrophic failure.
When Dateline continues.
We are reusing N95 masks and our shields.
And honestly, it's pretty terrifying. We're all getting exposed.
We have to risk possibly our own lives and the lives of our families to be able to take care of our patients. And it's not a position any of us should be put in.
Of all the delays and missteps in the crisis response, failing to supply enough personal protective equipment, PPE, to frontline workers may be the most egregious.
Could it have been anticipated that all 50 states would suddenly have this urgent demand for PPE at the very same time?
I think we absolutely could have anticipated that all 50 states would have needs at some point during this, you know, the outbreak, which ultimately became a pandemic, even going back into January.
Dr. Cameron says if the administration had been following the playbook, it would have determined there wasn't enough PPE in January. But in January and February, the U.S. sent PPE overseas, like this 18-ton shipment to China in February, on the day the World Health Organization warned of a global PPE shortage. And while the federal government started the procurement process for PPE in late February, purchase records show the first order of new N95 masks wasn't placed until March 12th.
We are continuing to see a debate playing out right now about who's in charge, who orders equipment, the feds or the states. What did you conclude in your preparation of the playbook?
So what we said in the playbook is, yes, there is a lot of authority that exists at the state and local level, but there will also be an expectation that the federal government will provide leadership.
Inside the White House, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was running his own task force, taking on the PPE problem by recruiting private sector leaders, like Eric Ries, a quick startup guru.
March 21st, you get a call from a Silicon Valley friend. What were you asked to do?
The initial request was to build a website that could match the supply and demand of PPE.
But Ries realized the growing PPE crisis needed more than just a website. He saw a need to coordinate all the public and private efforts, the manufacturers, health insurers, financiers, and grassroots organizations already plugging the gaps. So he launched the PPE Coalition, connecting makers of PPE with those who needed it most. Ries, the son of two doctors, felt he was on a life-or-death mission to stop the PPE supply from drying up.
I don't know how to explain how it felt. It was like a ticking time bomb.
Ries thought his work would be a stopgap measure until the government took over coordinating PPE on a national scale.
We always thought the cavalry was coming.
But that didn't happen. He says he reached out to the government and Kushner's task force, but didn't get a response. He is surprised so much life-saving work remains in the hands of volunteers.
You've cautioned against judging right now, but I do have to ask you from your perspective, who or what is to blame for the shortage of PPE during this crisis?
It's a question above my pay grade and over my head. All I can say is we are not prepared, even now as a society, for this problem. And it's not even close. It's not like we got a B minus and we almost did it. It's a catastrophic failure.
We have spoken to experts who put together what was called the playbook. And one of the things they stress in their planning was that PPE should have been part of the planning even in January. Does it disappoint you that that didn't happen?
The first time I heard that, I was outraged and shocked.
The White House has said their own plans were more robust than the playbook, and recently pointed to a pandemic exercise they ran last year.
We did a whole exercise on pandemic preparedness in August of last year and had an entire after-action report put together.
The exercise she's talking about was a pandemic war game called Crimson Contagion that tested government response in a flu pandemic scenario. We spoke to people who participated and obtained a draft after-action report. We learned that the exercise exposed vulnerabilities in the system with leadership, states getting federal help, and problems with testing and PPE supply. Failings that didn't get fixed before the real pandemic hit, and that might have been averted using the playbook written years earlier.
And to critics who say it is outdated, that other policies have superseded it, you say what?
I would say the playbook is not outdated. Look at the questions that it asked. I think they're completely relevant today.
At this snapshot in time, what grade would you give the Trump administration in terms of its response to this virus?
Honestly, Lester, I would have to give them a failing grade at this point.
Coming up,
we're looking at 100,000 dead in this country. Sir, how on earth did we get here?
Every death that we've experienced is a tragedy.
The White House responds. The steps in the playbook for handling a viral outbreak here had been largely ignored. So in that vacuum, the virus was able to write a playbook of its own, random and cruel.
I heard the brawls.
Felicia Temple, whose talents got noticed after appearing on The Voice, has witnessed that firsthand. We told you she was a singer. What we didn't tell you is that she is also a nurse, who raced back in March to help colleagues and patients at her old hospital, Holy Name Medical Center in Teaneck, New Jersey. She's seen this highly infectious disease keep families from the bedsides of loved ones.
You have to essentially stand in as a surrogate for family.
Yes, absolutely. I had a young woman and she had a do not resuscitate order. And the other nurse said, I'm sure that there's something that we can do to save her. And I said, unfortunately, there isn't. So I said, let's just hold her hand and let's just pray over her. And she did go and it was terrible.
Sometimes the patients have been people she's known for years and loved.
My heart just dropped because he's a hospital treasure.
75-year-old Jesus Villaluz was a patient transporter, ferrying the sick from room to room until he became a COVID patient himself and died at the very hospital he dedicated himself to.
As they wheeled him out of the unit, all of the staff lined the walls while his body went past, just to pay tribute to him.
This moment of Jesus' body being carried through the hospital has become an iconic image of the sacrifices made by healthcare workers during this pandemic. Despite the lives lost, the president has consistently said the government's response has been a success. Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar echoed that when he sat down with me for an interview 2 weeks ago.
We're in a country with vast resources, vast expertise, yet we're looking at 100,000 dead in this country, the most infections of any country. Sir, how on earth did we get here?
So first, we're a very large country. So it's important to remember that while our numbers are large, our country is large also. And every death that we've experienced is a tragedy. But we're testing now in historic numbers. The more you test, of course, the more you're going to identify in terms of cases.
But back to my question of how we got here. Do you not ask what mistakes were made, what things should have been done? The timing, do those things keep you up at night?
China should have been more transparent, open, and cooperative, I'll tell you that much. China knew that they had human-to-human transmission, and yet they were concealing that. They knew they had asymptomatic transmission, yet they concealed that.
But by early January, they had acknowledged a novel coronavirus was out there. Should the U.S. have been taking steps right from the get-go to work on things like personal protection equipment, set up testing procedures to identify where it is?
We, in fact, did every one of those things. We scaled up the National Security Council at the White House. We put in place an emergency operations team at the CDC. We scaled up a government-wide countermeasures group that was working on vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics. We reached out to personal protective equipment manufacturers and began the process to scale up domestic manufacturing.
But the first purchase orders for PPE weren't issued by the government until March. Why did that not occur earlier?
Well, that's not actually true. We were procuring N95 respirators earlier in late January and early February with the money that we had. And then
we asked Secretary Azar's office for documentation of those early purchases, but it did not provide any. Our own search of government databases found no federal orders for N95 masks before March.
Were you aware of the 2016 pandemic playbook?
Oh, of course, of course. We were presented with the Obama administration's rather thin pandemic playbook, and we found that inadequate. And we and the Trump administration actually revised and fleshed out the pandemic planning to be much more robust.
Then again, the playbook's authors say it was meant to be a concise guide so leaders could act quickly during a crisis. And there is overlap between the playbook and the administration's plans.
But some of the things in that playbook were mirrored in your own work, this administration's work, and yet they weren't done. Did the administration ignore some of its own work, its own findings on dealing with the pandemic?
Lester, we did exactly what the pandemic playbook says to do.
In our interview, Secretary Azar pointed again to the China travel ban. But the secretary does concede one delay. He says time was lost when the CDC, which reports to him, failed to get working test kits out quickly to public health labs.
South Korea had its first coronavirus confirmed case the same day the United States did. But by the time we distributed a working test, they had already run 100,000 tests. The U.S. only 472. How did that happen?
So South Korea had an admirable response, and we should give them credit for it. They're a much smaller country. They also had a very localized outbreak. And because of different approaches to public health, they were able to isolate all of those individuals.
You're saying that the South Korea model is not reflective of the U.S. experience and that there's nothing there to be replicated?
Oh, I think that as we move forward, we've learned important lessons about just how with a novel coronavirus, something, a pandemic like this, our testing system in the United States was not built for that.
But the need to test was laid out in your own exercises, this administration's exercise, as well as that 2016 playbook, wasn't it?
Well, most of the pandemic planning had been around pandemic flu. Remember, you have a novel pathogen, coronavirus here, a totally novel one. You've got to get the private sector to develop those tests and to manufacture and replicate those across the country.
The secretary says the federal government's overall efforts save lives, including its recommendations on social distancing issued in March. But could we have acted faster?
As you know, recently there was some modeling that suggested that had there been an earlier response, even a week earlier, it might have saved tens of thousands of lives. Do you accept those conclusions, that modeling?
I think it's important to recognize that the genomic data is indicating that New York was seeded by cases coming over from Italy and from Europe. And had New York City, New York State taken action sooner to engage in community mitigation efforts, that certainly could have slowed the spread of disease.
New York officials have said they lacked federal direction early on. Azar points out that the administration had to weigh closures against the impact to the economy and to Americans who needed regular health care even during a pandemic. He says this president has risen to all those challenges.
The president has often been at odds with his own scientists. And there have been, let's face it, some conflicting signals coming from government. Do you regret any of that? Do you wish that he had not done some of the things that he has done?
The president hasn't been at odds with his public health advisors. He works closely with them. He takes their advice.
But he's been rooting on states, calling on states to open up, even as they essentially violate the White House guidelines on how to safely open up. That's not being at odds with your scientists?
Well, the guidelines are guidelines. They're simply a potential markers for how one would progress to reopening. But each governor knows the lay of the land in their state better.
As states adjust to a new normal, the people most impacted by the virus, like Ana Duarte, can't help but look back and think about the what-ifs. She wonders, would faster action by leaders have prevented her daughter, Carla, from becoming infected? And speaking of Carla,
I heard the nurse talking to my mom, and then I eventually, you know, I started like opening my eyes.
Despite being so sick and on a ventilator, Carla eventually rallied, and on April 19th, got the all clear to go home. With her mom's help, she's slowly regaining her strength. The virus has disproportionately killed people of color in this country. Terrica Parks feels lucky to be among the survivors.
My mind like, yes, this is it. I'm going home.
She says the day she left the hospital felt like a rebirth of sorts.
It almost brought tears to my eyes to know that I made it to the other side. I like to call it the other side. You know, outside from behind that hospital window.
Safe to say, we all want to be on the other side of this. Far less certain exactly when that will be.
Now, maybe we should be writing a new kind of playbook. One that points us away from the next disaster by understanding how we handled this one. An honest accounting of what we got right and everything we got wrong. That's all for this special edition of Dateline. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for watching.